Hi, Marco Werman here. 2022 is just around the corner. Our team at The World has so many stories we plan to bring you in the new year. More stories from more places, more deep dive investigations, more music from around the globe, and more of the nuanced, human-centered international reporting you rely on. You've heard me say it here before, we just can't do it alone. We need your help. To everyone who has already donated to our fundraiser this year, thank you so much. Your support means everything. We are still short of our goal, but luckily our deadline has been extended. We have until December 31st to raise $67,000. As of right now, we're halfway there. If you haven't donated yet, please make your gift today to help power the world for another year. You can donate at theworld.org/give. Thank you, and now the show.
The following message is brought to you by Wise, the smart way to move money internationally. An American sends money to a friend in Australia. An Australian buys from an Indian shop online. An Indian freelancer gets paid by a client in Germany. What do all these people have in common? They use Wise, which means they always get the real exchange rate and super low fees when managing their money across borders. And you will too. Wise has a multi-currency debit card, so you can avoid high fees when you shop overseas, online, or in-store. Wise is designed by international people for international people. Try Wise for free at wise.com/world.
Today on The World, in New Zealand, a bold new plan to get people to stop smoking. In Mexico, anger over Washington's plan to build electric cars. And in Hong Kong, three pro-democracy leaders found guilty of incitement. Their crime? Doing what they've done for the past 30-plus years.
Hong Kongers would pour into the city's largest park a blanket of candlelight as they remember the 1989 Tiananmen dead.
Critics are calling today's sentence a crackdown on memory. Also today, binge watchers around the world are discovering Turkish TV, slicker than soaps and now dubbed in Spanish.
The way they build the crescendo, the dramatic crescendo, is way more intense than in a telenovela.
And getting lots of eyes. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thanks for joining us today. We've all known for decades that cigarette smoking is lethal and generally bad for your health and those around you. Smokers, though, have a hard time kicking the habit. But what if the government told them they have to? That's what New Zealand has unveiled today, a bold new law around a simple strategy, never let people start smoking. Starting early next year, New Zealand will gradually raise the legal purchasing age year by year until nobody there can buy cigarettes.
Which will mean that no one aged older than 14 at the time the planned legislation comes into force will ever be able to legally purchase cigarettes.
New Zealand Associate Health Minister Aisha Viral there. To learn how the new law will work, we reached out to Chris Bullen at the University of Auckland. He researches smoking in New Zealand.
If you're born after a certain year, then you will never be able to buy tobacco. So let's say if you're born in 2009, 2010, 2011, that whole cohort, it will be illegal for them to be sold tobacco if they present to a store and ask for some cigarettes.
What if you're 50 and you're really hooked on cigarettes?
Yeah, 50-year-old now, sure, you'll still be able to buy cigarettes. But one of the strategies is to reduce nicotine in cigarettes to below addictive levels. So over time, all the nicotine in New Zealand that will be on sale will be reduced nicotine cigarettes. So we're imagining, and we've found research evidence to support this, that smokers will move away from smoking. They will want to quit or smoke harm-reduced products, or vape, you know, or go on to long-term nicotine replacement or some other lower-harm products instead of smoking because they won't get their nicotine from the cigarettes anymore. So what we're hoping is to see right across all age groups, not just the youth cohort who won't be able to be sold tobacco, but current smokers will move away, as they are doing anyway in high numbers. We had over 90,000 in a population of 5.5 million, 90,000 smokers quit just last year.
Chris, elaborate on the sale of cigarettes in New Zealand. How's the government dealing with tobacco manufacturers? Are they upset?
Oh, of course, the tobacco industry is upset, and they're making all sorts of claims. They're saying that small retailers will go bust because they won't be able to sell cigarettes. They're claiming that the illegal trade will skyrocket. This is very much from the tobacco industry playbooks. So the small retailers will be encouraged to find other ways to supplement their income. And in New Zealand, we have a more pragmatic approach to selling vaping products than you do in the North American marketplace. And so we imagine that a lot of smokers will substitute vaping for smoking. The government's taking what's called a risk proportionate approach, seeing that smoking is the most lethal product on the market. So they're trying to shift people who can't quit nicotine to move to less harmful products, and then boosting the border controls and monitoring of surveillance of illicit tobacco smuggling.
If this law works in New Zealand, and you seem pretty confident that it will, can it be duplicated elsewhere?
My understanding is that where it has been proposed, it's been difficult to follow through to get the political support and to actually get the law changed to implement it. We're quietly confident that this will go through because our pretty strong tobacco control policies in New Zealand have enjoyed cross-party support. Our governments are all very, very supportive of tough tobacco legislation. And the populace, including smokers, 70% of smokers want to see tougher laws on smoking. So the population at large wants to get rid of smoking. There will be elements that may be able to be duplicated. This will give encouragement to other countries to try and experiment with some of these policies. It's something I think we can do and we will do.
Chris Bullen is a professor of public health at the University of Auckland in New Zealand, speaking with us about a new law and strategy there to make the country smoke-free by 2025. Chris, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Good to talk to you.
It is time to shut down the prison at Guantanamo Bay. For nearly two decades, many American leaders have uttered those words. At a Senate hearing this week, there was bipartisan frustration that no one from the Biden administration attended. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham expressed the dilemma of what to do about the detention camp.
I don't want to torture anybody. I want to give them due process consistent with being at war. And if necessary, I want to hold them as long as it takes to keep us safe or we believe that they're no longer a threat.
We turn now to New York Times reporter Carol Rosenberg, who is at Guantanamo. She's covered the detention camps since the first prisoners arrived in 2002. Remind us of how many prisoners are still at Guantanamo, Carol, and what their status is.
There are currently 39 detainees here, prisoners, and they're divided into three groups. A third of them, roughly, have been approved for transfer if the Biden administration can make arrangements with countries to take them with security assurances that actually satisfy Defense Secretary Austin. Another third are defined as what I call forever prisoners, meaning they're not eligible for release and they are not being charged with crimes. They're the equivalent of POWs in this forever war on terror, and there's no intention to charge them. And then the last third are charged with crimes and are in various, mostly very premature proceedings in the court here that have been going on for more than a decade. And the best known among them are the five men who are accused of plotting the 9/11 attacks. And the one I'm down here for now, which is also very preliminary hearings, still trying to reach a trial date in the USS Cole bombing.
In a nutshell, what is holding up due process for the remaining prisoners there?
In terms of the trials, the biggest issue is that rather than pick those men up when they were captured in Pakistan back in 2002 and 2003 and bring them to New York and put them on trial, the Bush administration disappeared them into the black sites of the CIA, where they were tortured, sleep deprived, beaten, left nude, in some instances waterboarded, and then brought to Guantanamo 3 and 4 years later. The military commissions is still trying to figure out how to handle that period of history and give them some sort of fair trial. Men who are cleared but haven't left, at least one of them has been approved for transfer as far back as the Bush administration, and it's a matter of finding countries that are willing to take them. That process really just came to a halt after the Obama administration. By the way, there's 13 of these men who have been recommended for transfer.
So does the Biden White House have the sole power to make the transfers happen?
In terms of bringing them to the United States, they cannot, because Congress has blocked through legislation the use of any federal funds for constructing or transferring detainees to the United States for any reason, trial, medical care, or even, you know, were somebody to be convicted for execution.
What about to other countries?
Yes, there's a number of Pakistani men who've been cleared who could be going back to Pakistan if the Americans can make those agreements. Reaching these agreements are difficult, but not impossible. There is a whole cadre of people who are interested in getting some of these men who are most damaged into some sort of a care setting. And that would require, you know, making agreements with other countries to care for them. Some of them are very damaged individuals.
You've been covering the detention camp at Guantanamo from the beginning, Carol. What has changed practically for the prisoners there since 2002?
If you close your eyes and imagine men in orange jumpsuits on their knees, that was opening day at Guantanamo Bay. They were in a cage called Camp X-Ray. Nobody's been held in Camp X-Ray for 19 years, and they've been moved inside. But one of the problems I'm experiencing is the Trump administration and the military under the Trump administration just shut down all access to the prison. Not that the journalists were engaging with them, but they are more isolated than ever. Very few people have laid eyes on them. The Red Cross didn't come for about a half a year in the beginning of COVID. And, you know, there's an expectation that Biden should be able to get some of them out. But it's a lonely place.
Carol Rosenberg with the New York Times speaking with us from Camp Justice at Guantanamo Bay. Carol, as always, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you so much, Marco.
President Biden wants Americans to drive cleaner cars. To get there, he's planning to give new car buyers a big tax incentive to buy electric, but only for vehicles made in the U.S. of A. That's brought some serious pushback from Canada and Mexico. They argue that Biden's plan would jeopardize jobs inside their countries. From Mexico, the world's Latin America correspondent Jorge Valencia reports.
The jobs for electric car manufacturing in Mexico are all right here at the Ford Mustang Mach-E assembly plant. It's this entire complex right in front of me that covers more than 200 acres just north of Mexico City. Tractor trailers drive in and out all day. Workers wearing neon vests and hard hats come out during shift change. About 1,000 people work here, and they make a model of the Mustang that is an SUV and can run for 300 miles with a single charge. In the year since they started making the Mustang Mach-E, they've rolled out more than 61,000 SUVs and exported them from here in the heart of Mexico to more than 20 countries. It's exactly this type of plant, and more importantly, the jobs that it provides, that's at the center of a big drama between Mexico's economy ministry, Canada's finance ministry, and the White House. Promoting zero-emissions vehicles is of benefit to everyone, says Armando Soto, a car industry consultant based in Mexico City. But Soto argues that the Biden administration's newest push for electric vehicles is not the best approach. The U.S. Senate is considering a Biden plan to give a $4,500 tax credit for cars made in American plants that are unionized. It would add an extra $500 credit for cars with batteries made in the U.S.
Y al especificar que solamente te voy a dar esos $500 de crédito si está hecha en Estados Unidos, ya estás generando una distorsión, ya estás generando...
Soto argues that the proposed tax credits would distort the market, and top economic officials in both Mexico and Canada agree. They say Biden's plans for the electric car sales violate the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement, which went into effect just last year. The bottom line for America's biggest trading partners is that car and parts manufacturers won't want to set up shop there for many years to come.
Hay que impulsar la cadena productiva en toda la región para generar la competitividad en la región, ¿no?
Soto says the U.S. should be promoting growth for the whole region. After all, North America is far behind China and the European Union in electric vehicle sales. But Edward Alden, who teaches international trade at Western Washington University, says it's important to recognize how critical this plan is to the Biden agenda.
What Biden is trying to sell the American people, the transition to clean energy, will be a boon. It will create lots and lots of great union jobs in the United States. This is not the loss of all these wonderful old fossil jobs. It's creation of these great new union jobs associated with clean energy.
Alden says that even though Mexico and Canada are threatening to take legal action against the U.S., the Biden administration won't set aside the plan easily. So José Luis de la Cruz Gallegos, an economist who focuses on industrial development in Mexico, says Mexico should be looking beyond its trade deal with the U.S. and Canada.
Bueno, al final del día, tienes que generar un mejor entorno para atraer esas inversiones. Es decir,
De la Cruz Gallegos says car and parts manufacturers are looking to reduce their carbon footprint. So he says the Mexican government should be incentivizing the production of wind and solar energy. That might help attract more employers like Ford. For The World, I'm Jorge Valencia in Mexico State, Mexico.
Mining metals at the bottom of the ocean for car batteries. That's just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Demand for metals to make things like batteries and electric vehicles is expected to skyrocket in the next 20 years. To meet that, mining companies are eyeing deposits on the seafloor, deep under the ocean. This week, a UN agency is meeting to discuss regulations that could open up the deep sea. The World's environment correspondent Carolyn Beeler reports.
The hottest deep sea mining prospect right now is a patch of the Pacific the size of a large country that stretches from Mexico to Hawaii. The targets there are potato-shaped lumps of metal called polymetallic nodules.
They literally just lie on the ocean floor like golf balls on a driving range.
Jared Barron is the CEO of The Metals Company. It's a Vancouver-based firm hoping to be the first of more than a dozen interested companies to start mining those nodules.
It's a miraculous coincidence that they contain all the base metals that we need to build batteries.
They're made of copper, nickel, cobalt, iron, manganese, rare earth metals. The metals company argues that collecting these nodules with a rover crawling across 2,000 square miles of seafloor a year would be less destructive than mining minerals on land.
You know, it doesn't seem to make sense to be destroying our biodiverse rainforests to produce the metals that we need to be able to build an electric vehicle. Surely we must investigate where can we get these materials from with the lightest planetary touch from an environmental perspective.
The metals company argues that's the deep sea. But some scientists, environmental groups, and even large companies disagree. These deep sea environments are among the most pristine and least understood on Earth.
The biggest concern is the lack of information.
Lisa Levin is a biological oceanographer at Scripps Institution of Oceanography at the University of California, San Diego. She's one of hundreds of scientists calling for a moratorium on deep sea mining, partly because many of the creatures that live there are unknown to science.
We don't know how most of those organisms live and function and what their role is in their ecosystems. And more importantly, how those ecosystems could affect or interact with human beings.
Corals, sponges, and single-celled organisms live on the metal nodules themselves. Destroying them could have impacts up the food chain and potentially on humans, Levin says.
It sounds like something far-fetched, but marine organisms are creating all sorts of new anti-cancer, anti-inflammatory, antibiotic drugs. So there is concern about loss of biodiversity in that regard.
The question of whether to mine or not to mine is coming to a head now. Under an obscure law, the metals company could be allowed to start deep sea mining as early as the summer of 2023. That's whether or not the UN's International Seabed Authority has finalized mining regulations by then and figured out how to distribute the proceeds fairly. The group has been meeting in Kingston, Jamaica this week, and several countries have expressed concern about finishing the rules in time. Allison Stone Roof spoke for the host country.
Jamaica is not convinced that even with the best efforts of all sides, the time proposed is adequate to develop a strong, effective, balanced, comprehensive regulatory framework.
A few environmental organizations that spoke at the meeting went a step further. Duncan Curry called for a moratorium on behalf of the Deep Sea Conservation Coalition. I spoke to him afterward.
What we're seeing really, frankly, is a headlong rush to mine the deep sea. It is really quite a great concern.
Jared Barron, the metals company CEO, says the urgency is actually a good thing.
We have a climate crisis on our hands. We do not have time to sit around and support a moratorium.
He points out that the original deadline for finalizing deep sea mining rules was last year. He thinks there's plenty of time to finish that work by 2023. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
We've heard a lot about the Great Resignation, people fed up with their jobs and quitting. There's another workplace movement, the push to unionize. Among those looking to join a union, undocumented immigrants, even as their futures in the U.S. are not guaranteed. The World's Daisy Contreras explains.
Over the years, Yesenia Ramalez says she and co-workers talked about unionizing their nonprofit job. Nothing came out of those talks, though. But then the pandemic hit and the idea came up again.
They reached out to me and they were like, well, you know, are you willing to help us get this going?
Ramalez accepted. And last month, her employer, the Florence Immigrant and Refugee Rights Project, a leading national immigrant nonprofit based in Arizona, recognized their union. Ramalez is a senior legal assistant there. She also has DACA, or Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, which gives temporary protections from deportation and a work permit to some undocumented people. Courts are debating the fate of the program. It means Ramalez and several of her co-workers could lose their work permit at any moment. She says that uncertainty didn't sway her. Even if she didn't get to see the benefits of a union later, she wanted to help.
I want things to get better for people, regardless of whether or not it's going to get better for me.
Ramalez joins a movement of workers, many of them undocumented immigrants with work permits, unionizing their workplaces across the U.S. Even without those benefits, undocumented people are legally allowed to join unions and organize. Ramalez says her biggest obstacle was her mom.
I don't really think she understood what I was really doing as an immigrant, as a DACA recipient. Her words to me, or what she often says to me, is like, you have a great job. Why are you always, you know, stirring up trouble?
DACA recipients are in an interesting position to organize, says Janice Fine. She's a labor studies professor at Rutgers University in New Jersey.
They have a history of fighting hard and fighting really strategically and winning.
Fine is talking about the grassroots activism of young undocumented people that began over a decade ago. They marched in the streets, held rallies outside the White House, and publicly shared their stories and immigration status. All of that work pushed the Obama administration to pass DACA in 2012. Navy Dominguez was part of that. She now leads Unemployed Workers United, a nonprofit helping low-wage workers organize across several states in the Southwest. All of the skills she and others learned as young undocumented activists, they've applied to their current jobs, she says.
A lot of the folks that I know now are all doing amazing work in other sectors.
Dominguez says these efforts to unionize will help even if there's a future without DACA.
What we are doing is creating more and more potential ways of protecting more and more immigrant workers so that we can have a stronger labor movement.
Victor Narro knows about legacy labor movements, especially those where undocumented workers took the lead. Narro teaches labor studies at the UCLA Labor Center. He points to a key moment in the early 2000s.
The city of Los Angeles, janitors took to the streets, and many of these janitors were undocumented immigrants.
Janitors across the country followed and also went on strike. The result was a union contract for thousands of janitors. Narro says that unity changed the minds of labor union leaders who thought undocumented immigrants couldn't be convinced to organize or join unions. We're seeing that legacy today with many DACA recipients, he says.
They weren't afraid to come out public about their immigration status when they led the movement that led to DACA. And they're not afraid to organize in the workplace.
Yesenia Ramalez, the DACA recipient in Arizona, says she's confident her choices will lead to more support and less burnout on the job.
That's only going to improve life for all of us.
And for generations to come, she says. For The World, I'm Daisy Contreras.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. China is allegedly looking to build a naval base off the Atlantic coast of Africa. That's raising alarm bells at the Pentagon.
China's basing in the short term may not be a serious threat, but it's a door opener.
We'll look at what's on the other side of that door, and we remember the wickedest bass player to come from Jamaica. Still ahead, here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Two organizations that defend journalists are worried about China. According to the group Reporters Without Borders, China is the world's biggest captor of journalists, with at least 127 reporters in state custody currently. Globally, the number of journalists in prison is at a new high. That's the takeaway from a new report by the Committee to Protect Journalists. Meanwhile, in Hong Kong, a court found three pro-democracy figures, including media tycoon Jimmy Lai, guilty of taking part in last year's banned Tiananmen Square massacre vigil. Tom Grundy, the editor-in-chief of the independent Hong Kong Free Press, has been watching the trial closely. He described the scene in front of the courthouse today.
About 100 people queuing outside, cheering for Jimmy Lai, the media tycoon, and wishing him a happy birthday as he entered the dock today. He turned 74 this week, and outside there was a lone pro-democracy protester calling for the release of political prisoners, lots of police, of course, and a pro-Beijing group calling for a heavy sentencing. These three Democrats today were the only ones to plead not guilty to these charges linked to the commemorative vigil. Every year, usually tens, perhaps hundreds of thousands of Hong Kongers would pour into the city's largest park, a blanket of candlelight as they remember the 1989 Tiananmen dead. Last year, the government banned it, citing COVID, but people showed up anyway. And now on Thursday, Judge Amanda Woodcock said that the very fact that Jimmy Lai just showed up at a fountain outside the park was incitement enough. He didn't have to say anything. Likewise, organizer Chow Hang Tung didn't have to explicitly call for anyone to attend, but her Facebook post, which said, "See you tonight," was implicit enough to see her charged.
So three people charged today. Jimmy Lai, the best known. He's a billionaire, as you said. Remind us who he is and why there's this focus on him.
Well, long loathed by the mainland authorities, he's the founder of the now defunct pro-democracy tabloid Apple Daily. And it's very unlikely that he will see the light of day, to be honest. I would say that since the onset of the security law last June, the authorities have somewhat sought to erase the memory of the Tiananmen massacre in the same way you see in the mainland, where there is outright censorship of all mention of it. Since last June, books have been pulled from library shelves, textbooks censored. The organizers have all been rounded up and a museum raided, its exhibits confiscated. I can't imagine that even after COVID, Hong Kong will see another mass vigil of the kinds we've witnessed for decades.
Mm. So you're saying it's Beijing's new security law that's breaking this illegal ground in Hong Kong over these vigils for the Tiananmen massacre?
Yeah, I mean, most pro-democracy figures in the city are either behind bars, they've been jailed or are awaiting trial. The government has suggested that, you know, this has brought stability after the 2019 pro-democracy protests and unrest.
Mm, not surprising Beijing would see it as bringing stability. I mean, you're an editor and co-founder of an independent media outlet in Hong Kong. What precautions are you taking? Are you worried?
Well, we try and keep the security law at the back of our minds and at the front of our minds. Our mission, our code of ethics as an independent outlet, we're funded by the public, where there's no tycoons or, you know, government or anything behind us. We see that the press freedom is under fire and we've sort of stood our ground and we continue to fundraise and take one day at a time, I suppose. And I have to say that we have not been self-censoring the hard news at all. We've sought to Karen as normal. I think if one were to swap that around and keep the security law at the front of your mind, you will not only go a bit crazy because of not knowing where the red lines are, but you are liable to self-censor. So we sort of held our nerve throughout this year, and I do hope that we'll be able to continue. But, you know, as we know, the pro-democracy Apple Daily is no more. Its senior staff may face years in prison. Barely a week goes by without some kind of a big change or censorship at the local public broadcaster, and concerns into the new year now about a fake news law on the horizon, even possible internet controls that have been hinted at. Top officials, you know, have said several times they want to bolster supervision of the media. I don't know whether we will see the likes of the Great Firewall as we do over the border, but certainly it's had a chilling effect across the media, and we're just seeking to keep calm and carry on, I guess.
Tom, it has been an extremely difficult year for journalists globally, as a report from the Committee to Protect Journalists makes clear. Just looking at Hong Kong, though, what do you see ahead for 2022? Where do things go from here for press freedom on the island?
Well, aside from the security law, we've just seen an anti-doxing law come in. I know that the government has perhaps been looking towards Singapore in terms of a fake news law. It's almost an impossible task to think of, you know, what you may be doing wrong or right. So in one sense, you kind of become zen, because if the authorities are going to pounce, then they will.
Tom Grundy is the editor-in-chief and co-founder of the Hong Kong Free Press, an independent English media outlet in Hong Kong. Tom, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
The U.S. says that China is planning to build a new naval base off the coast of Central Africa. That's according to the Wall Street Journal. Beijing denies the claim. But if it comes to pass, the base would be China's first facility in the Atlantic Ocean. The Pentagon is worried that it could be the beginning of Chinese warships closing the distance to America's coastline. The World's Patrick Nguyen reports.
Stephen Townsend is a four-star American general. He's taken part in the U.S. invasions of Panama, Afghanistan, and Iraq. So he's been around. But these days, what worries him most is China in Africa.
This is the most significant threat, I think, from China, would be to gain a militarily useful naval facility on the Atlantic coast of Africa.
That was General Townsend speaking to Congress earlier this year. He is the head of the U.S. military's Africa Command. Now it appears that China has actually picked out where it wants to build that African base. Equatorial Guinea, a tiny nation the size of Massachusetts. It's on the Gulf of Guinea, and it's just south of Nigeria. President Joe Biden even sent one of his security advisors to Equatorial Guinea just to tell its leader, do not let China build this base. But why all this worry?
China's basing in the short term may not be a serious threat, but it's a door opener.
Carl Schuster is a former U.S. Naval Intelligence Officer. He's now a scholar with Hawaii Pacific University. I asked him, a door opener to what exactly?
It is a change in the balance of power and influence in a region that is within reach of us.
Well, sort of in reach. Equatorial Guinea is 6,000 miles from the U.S. East Coast, but it is on the Atlantic, and for the Pentagon, that is too close for comfort. China does have logical reasons to want this base, reasons that have nothing to do with America. China gets a lot of minerals from West Africa, like cobalt, you need that to make electric cars, or copper, manganese, used in making batteries and steel, plus oil and gas, vital stuff, all loaded onto cargo ships in Africa and sent to China.
If you're looking to protect your maritime sources for those materials and monitor piracy in those areas, the Gulf of Guinea is a very important place.
Yes, piracy. That area is the new piracy hotspot in the world. So what should China do? Well, Washington considers the U.S. Navy to be the police of the global seas and would prefer China to say, we'll trust you to keep the ocean safe. But Carl Schuster says, for a Chinese naval commander, that's a tough sell.
If you're looking at protecting your maritime commerce, would you be entirely dependent on a country whose relationship with you is not assured?
Also, there are 5 million Chinese citizens working in Africa. Beijing tells them, if you face danger, our military is there to help you. This idea has been propagated through a hit movie, Wolf Warrior 2, which is basically about a Chinese Rambo saving Chinese citizens from rebels in Africa. That is one of the most watched Chinese movies ever. But back to real life. What is it that China might actually want to build on the coast of Equatorial Guinea? Maybe just essentially a gas station for warships, providing fuel and food. A pit stop. What the Pentagon fears is a real base, where ships can rearm, get repairs, like a gas station, plus an armory, plus a garage. America has many bases like that, and much bigger, across the Pacific, in Japan, South Korea, and Guam. By the way, all of those places are closer to China than the Gulf of Guinea is to the U.S. If this is all sounding reminiscent of the U.S.-Soviet Cold War era, Carl Schuster says, keep this in mind.
The Soviets were one-dimensional. All they thought of was in terms of military power. China is a much more complex and sophisticated competitor.
Schuster says China can be patient with its expansion into the Atlantic, and that its warships will mostly focus on protecting China's trade interest, and that China probably won't suddenly cross any bright red lines by sending super lethal ships anytime soon.
At the moment, I don't think Chinese submarines and large combatants are operating in the Atlantic, and they're certainly not yet present in the Caribbean.
The Pentagon is still worried that China will first open a base in Western Africa, then one a little closer and a little closer until its warships are in range of America's front yard. But keep this in mind. The U.S. Navy has 11 aircraft carriers, and they routinely sail near China's coast. Beijing has 2, and so far, they've never strayed all that far from home. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
When natural disasters strike, aid groups are often the first on the scene. They truck in food, water, and tents. In war zones, they staff hospitals. In short, they provide critical, life-saving support. But over the past decade, disturbing reports have surfaced about some of these workers who have used their positions to exploit women and girls. A recent study about UN peacekeepers highlights just how pervasive the abuse is and how it drives women and their children deeper into poverty. Susan Bartels co-authored the study. She's an MD and an associate professor of public health at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario. Susan, you've been studying abuses by peacekeepers for years. Tell us about your most recent study done in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
So we interviewed men, women, and adolescents across six different communities in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, just over 2,800 people. The purpose was to understand how foreign peacekeepers interact with local women and girls. Participants in our research were not prompted to speak about sexual interactions. Instead, it was left open. And of the 2,800, three quarters talked about sexual interactions with peacekeepers. So again, either that they themselves had engaged with peacekeepers or that somebody they knew had. And our most recent publication focuses on the adolescents. And without prompting, three quarters of the 220 adolescents talked about either themselves having had sex with peacekeepers or somebody they know.
So clearly something is going on. We just don't know exactly how much. But in the case of Congo, were you able to extract whether the sex was consensual or was it forced?
The sex was by and large transactional, meaning that there was an exchange of sex by local women and girls for food or money most often. And I think this represents a real abuse of power. If you think about these girls who often lack access to education, are unable to pay their school fees, are facing food insecurity. In some cases, these girls are trying to help feed their younger siblings. And if they have such few options, such constrained choices to meet their basic needs and their family's basic needs, they become very vulnerable to sexual exploitation and abuse. And you can imagine the inherent power differential when you have a foreign peacekeeper who is well paid, has a gun, you know, has access to weapons. And so for this sex to be bought and paid for, it is such a gross abuse of power.
The UN states it has zero tolerance for sexual exploitation among its workforce, but clearly the abuse continues. Why is that?
Part of the issue is that most sexual exploitation and abuse, at least in our experience and from our data, goes unreported to the UN. And so while they report a number of cases of allegations, they make this data publicly available, it is really the tip of the iceberg, and most cases go unreported. At the end of the day, the burden is on the survivor. And so what we have found in speaking with local community members, in working with our partners and from our data, is that what happens more often is an informal reporting. So if a woman or girl has experienced abuse or exploitation, she will go to the implicated soldier and request money as a reparation.
So often these peacekeepers father children with local women. Does the UN make sure that these fathers are paying to support the children they left behind? I mean, can that even be enforced?
It's very difficult to enforce and is a really important issue that we have been looking at as well. In our research in DRC, we are finding that a large percentage of our interviews included peacekeeper father children. They are also known as peace babies. In Haiti, we conducted a similar study with Haitian community members around UN bases, and we did also find peacekeeper fathered children or peace babies, but not as much as in the Congo. The magnitude appears to be higher in the DRC.
With this exploitation of women, can you make the connection to how this even exacerbates the poverty of children?
Yes. What we know from both contexts, Haiti and DRC, in almost all circumstances, when it comes to be known that a peacekeeper has had sexual relations with a community member, and or if a pregnancy has resulted, the UN's response is almost always to send the peacekeeper home or to redeploy him to a new location. So in most cases, the peacekeeper is removed from the country, or at least from that location. And the women and girls who go on to give birth to these children are then left in heightened poverty. And so this perpetuates the cycle of poverty that these women and girls are experiencing and passing on to their children. And it really should be addressed at the level of the UN. The peacekeepers should, as fathers, should be providing support. And the national militaries who deploy these peacekeepers also should be held accountable.
Dr. Susan Bartels is a professor of emergency medicine at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario. Thank you very much for unpacking this survey.
Thank you for having me.
We reached out to the Office of UN Peacekeepers for their comment. They sent us a statement acknowledging that sexual misconduct is a problem and said they have a responsibility to prevent such exploitation. But the statement said the UN cannot do it alone. It read, quote, "Member states who provide troops and police have the primary responsibility over their personnel. They alone can ensure perpetrators are held accountable, and when crimes do occur, they are brought to justice," end quote. If you're searching for a new TV series, you might want to check out what's coming out of Turkey these days. The country is exporting some increasingly popular dramas called dizis. The easy comparison is soap operas or telenovelas, but dizis are really in a category of their own. KERA Stella Chavez checked out these Turkish TV shows and how they're winning over a range of fans here in the U.S.
They burned it down. Mama, this is a plot.
It's Friday night, and 21-year-old Alejandra Balbuena and her mom are on their couch, eyes glued to the big screen TV inside their home south of Dallas. They dissect everything that happens on this hit series called Herjai. Oh, these men are so dramatic, says Carlota Balbuena, Alejandra's mom. The show they're watching airs on the Spanish-language network Telemundo. But it's not your typical telenovela from Latin America. It's actually from Turkey, which has seen the global sales of its TV shows skyrocket from $10,000 more than a decade ago to more than $350 million today. Alejandra Balbuena says she and her mom used to watch a lot of telenovelas. Now they're stuck on Turkish dramas called dizi.
I had a moment with telenovelas where I didn't like the plots anymore. Like, I wasn't seeing them fall in love. I was seeing the same narcos, drugs. I'm seeing a lot of violence. I'm seeing these types of tropes that I don't like. Like, I feel like if you've seen one, like, narco novela, you've seen them all.
The desire for more variety helps explain why Turkish TV shows are not just on Netflix, but also on networks like Telemundo, dubbed in Spanish. For Spanish language TV, the turning point happened in 2019. That's when Univision added the Turkish drama called Kara Sevda, or Blind Love in English, to its primetime lineup.
They decided to test Kara Sevda, and it worked. That was huge for the Turkish, but huge.
Carolina Acosta Alzuru is a cultural studies professor at the University of Georgia in Athens and teaches a course on telenovelas. She's also tracked the rise of Turkish dizis in the U.S. and Latin America.
If you go to Latin America, people will call them either series turcas or telenovelas turcas, or simply las turcas.
Like telenovelas, she says dizis are full of emotions and elicit strong feelings among viewers. Many center around love stories and family, but they're also their own thing. Episodes air weekly, not daily, and can run more than 2 hours, like a movie.
The way they build the crescendo, the dramatic crescendo, is way more intense than in a telenovela.
The other difference? The music. Many dizis have original soundtracks. Characters have their own melodies. And there are the superfans.
Merhaba! Hoş geldiniz, everybody. Welcome back.
This is Dizzy for Dizzy.
Meet Ashley Faria and Kristen Curran, two friends in their 30s in Southern California. They started a podcast dedicated to Turkish shows. It's called Dizzy for Deezy. Curran and Faria just wrapped up season 2 of the podcast, where they discuss a show called Sen Çal Kapıma, or You Knock on My Door. One of the show's lead actors, Kerem Bürsen, who went to high school in Texas, has a big global following.
The Twitter fandom internationally, that show just blew up. Like, everyone was drawn in by the story, by the chemistry. I think the fact that we were all, the whole world was stuck at home pretty much, I think played a big part in that.
On social media, Curran and Faria have connected with Dizzy fans worldwide.
The crazy thing is, still most of our listeners are outside of the U.S. I mean, I'd love it if we could convince more Americans to watch Turkish shows so they could become more readily available here.
Some Dizzies are found on platforms like Netflix or YouTube, but not all. Others appear on sites that raise copyright issues, and then the shows vanish. For now, fans find the Turkish shows wherever they are. As for Curran and Faria, they're gearing up to watch a new Dizzy in January.
We're going to be covering Her Yerde Sen. So this is something we've been recommended by so many people.
Her Yerde Sen, or Everywhere You Go, is a rom-com featuring an architect and a young woman.
We know that they end up having to have close proximity by like renting the same house or something.
To find out the rest of the story, you'll just have to tune in. For the World, I'm Stella Chavez in Dallas.
We're glad you're with us each weekday for our show. There's another way we can connect that you should know about, The World's Morning Newsletter. You can get the top 3 news stories of the day we're following and links to our reporting that you might have missed straight from our editors to your email inbox waiting for you when you wake up. Subscribe to our newsletter, Top of the World, on our website, theworld.org. When Jamaica's Minister of Culture is the one to announce the death of a musician, you know it's significant. Bass player Robbie Shakespeare, who, along with drummer Sly Dunbar, created some of the heaviest rhythms to blast off the island. Sly and Robbie, as they were known, came as a pair, and now one half is gone. Robbie Shakespeare established his reputation playing on tracks like this one by reggae legend Peter Tosh in 1979. It's your music, reggae music, as far as I can. But his influence as a bassist also went well beyond Jamaica. He and Sly Dunbar held down the drum and bass on this 1983 classic by Grace Jones, My Jamaican Guy, only to have their sound reappear 13 years later as a sample on LL Cool J's Doin' It. Robbie Shakespeare's bass was heard by more people than we can count. We pay our respects to him today, a man who, as one of his fellow Jamaican artists exclaimed, had the wickedest bass. Let's close with some drum and bass simplicity. Sly Dunbar and the late Robbie Shakespeare doing it their way. The late Robbie Shakespeare on bass there. He was 68. We roll out today with his One People Rhythm. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong, and we'll see you right back here tomorrow.